Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
From iHeart Podcasts, I am Fab Five Freddy, and this is 50 Years of Hip Hop Podcast Series.
As rap music, hip-hop culture began to make a louder noise, began to have a more dominant impact, it became clear, and it was clear to a lot of people that really understood how the cultural pieces fall, that where we were as a time, particularly Black Americans coming out of the struggles of the 60s and 70s, it was a culture of, you know, typified by George Jefferson's show, you know, moving on up, putting that three-piece suit on and, you know, getting off the corner and being able to get into those executive suites in a deluxe apartment up in the sky. So that's where a lot of the mindset was, particularly of a lot of people that were controlling things, or the few Black executives that had some clout that were running things at radio, even doing things like, you know, Don Cornelius hosting Soul Train. A lot of these cats were not checking for this hip-hop, rap, energy, attitude, swagger, all of that. They were like, what are you doing? I'm not down with that energy at all. And that was a problem. And that was a big barrier that this rap music thing had to overcome. You had to be real clever about doing it. And once again, Christmas Rapping was one of those records that was able to get into the door. And once we got into the door, a lot of people knew, let's hold that door open and let the rest of the homies on in. So the resistance was real and, once again, cultural. Even I remember when Curtis Blow was on Soul Train, Don Cornelius wasn't totally cool, kind of dismissive. Like, this is a passing fad, I'm sure, you know, was the attitude that many had. I mean, not just Black, white, everybody. They were up against and in resistance to the force, the attitude, once again, the swagger, everything that hip-hop is, it was a problem.
Russell Simmons, record executive and entrepreneur.
I used to promote records in 1979. I was a record promoter. When Christmas Rapping came out, the only Black guy that really liked me was the boss, Bill Haywood. He died. But this liked me. He would go to club hopping with me. He would see me take him from the South Bronx to Harlem, to Midtown. The differences were profound in the club. I just mean today, love different kind of people. To Midtown, we go to Bentley's and Leviticus and Pegasus and Justine's and all these bougie clubs where he felt like his suit fit, right? And then we go downtown to the punk rock club, to the Peppermint Lounge, and to the Mud Club, and to the World. And then we would go to the gay club. We would go, which is where the records had to play or they wouldn't play on the radio. If you don't play in a gay club, Frankie Crockett is not the one. So we had to play in the garage, in the loft, and we had to play in Better Days, and we had to play in the gallery. Those famous DJs, Low Influence Radio, because they were gay clubs. And that's all we had was gay disco on the radio. So Frankie Crocker one night on Christmas Eve heard, and I was there, Christmas Rapping in the Paradise Garage. Next morning, on Christmas morning, he played it one time. Never played it again until a year later. But that's how it got played. Larry Levan played it. So, you know, the NBA club is very exclusive. Can't get in there from straight. But we, as Harlem, we figured out a way. We smoked dust and go to the gay club because that's where, and we had aspirations being music. And, you know, we would go check out, you know, the lesbian. But we really, that was really the place to go if you wanted to play music. Because that was what Judy Weinstein said. Let me make the final point. Black music made easy for white people to dance to. That's what they called disco. And she was the boss. She had disco DJs all over the country. And that chart, the disco chart, was more important than black radio in New York. And there was no funk on that chart. So that chart was WBLS and WKTU and the radio stations that played what we called black music. But it was never black music. It was black music made simple for white people to dance to. And during the same time that funk was everywhere else, we were locked out of the funk and created our own.
Russell's reminded me, man, of just how many incredible clubs we had in New York City up until not that long ago, y'all. It really makes me think, man. I mean, you can go to a different club every night, different flavor, different kind of music, you know, mostly on the downtown scene, but there were so many places to go and party in New York. Paradise Garage, I was up in there too. It was a gay club, but on Friday it was very mixed. And some of the hot chicks used to go through there. And that sound system Larry Levan had in the garage was something to behold. Designed by the legendary audio designer, rest in peace, Richard Long. But I just also want to add, it was when Rudy Giuliani was mayor, yeah, that guy, that he put in all these laws in effect that totally devastated the New York club scene. Like, he enacted these cabaret laws and everything that took a lot of the fun out of New York City and really was a big part in just a lot of people that had clubs. They just couldn't do it because it took lots of money to get these licenses and stuff. But that's really fascinating to just remember what it used to be as Russell lays it down. Curtis Blow's Christmas Rapping, which was released back in 1979. This was the first Christmas rap record, of course. You know, very few rap records at the time, but this was the first one all about Christmas, a real clever move. And it was also the first rap record on a major record label. This was released on Mercury Records. And this thing was the first record to get significant radio play across the board. And of course, largely behind this was Russell Simmons, Curtis Blow's manager at the time. Curtis Blow, legendary rapper and hip hop's first rap superstar.
I remember it was very, very difficult back in the days when radio would not play rap music. And that was a big problem for many of the artists. Christmas Rapping was so instrumental in the success to hip hop because it was the first holiday classic song it plays every year. And it was by design. I remember my producers coming to me and saying that, look, it's coming up. We are in studio in August and Rapper's Delight was the number one thing all over the nation right then. And so we were thinking, well, how can we capitalize on this rap on record? And so we came up with the idea of doing a Christmas rap, a holiday rap song that would play every year during Christmas time. So that was the greatest concept. And of course, you know, spiritually, Christmas is the birthday of Christ. So, you know, we can't lose doing a song about Jesus's birthday. So it has the longevity because it plays every year. And my hat goes out to all of the radio stations around the nation. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for playing that song like Nat King Cole. Man, 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 you made my legacy. You made my career. And not only me, but my family. And all of my fans, or I'll say friends, I don't have fans anymore. I only have friends. And so we thank you because you made it happen. And it was so important because I tell you, when the song came out, it was a monster hit on the radio. And not only on the radio, but in the clubs. And I'll tell you why. It was so hot because it played not only on during Christmas. The song came out December 19th in 1979, but it played all the way through to the summer of 1980.
Ed Lover, rapper, actor, radio personality, and former MTV VJ.
Oh God, the radio stations were playing whatever was popular in disco. Whatever was popular at the time, whatever kind of R&B was popular. We used to listen to Frankie Crocker, one of the greatest New York air personalities on WBLS. And then Disco 92 came along and they played a whole lot of disco. That was WKTU. So whatever was popular except hip hop, they played it. Whether it was a Fatback Band, a Confunction, or Minnie Riperton, or Earth, Wind & Fire, or Stevie Wonder, or Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, all of that stuff got played on the radio. Only time you got to hear anything remotely considered hip hop was on those tapes and, you know, the Breakout, Baron and the Breakout 4, and the Cold Crush Brothers, and the Fantastic Romantic 5. You got to hear that stuff that was going on in the mid to late 70s. You got to hear that. But before that, it was all disco.
KDAY Santa Monica. And for all of Los Angeles, we are the Hit Breakers.
Well, that was a little taste of KDAY 1580 on the AM dial in the Los Angeles area. Yes. K-Day was the first radio station in the country 24 hours to play hip-hop. You feel me? And it was so important. This is back in the 80s, the early 80s on. K-Day was the move. And Greg Mack was the genius behind it all. Brave guy that stepped out there, got this station, 1580 on the AM dial. All you West Coast people, LA, et cetera, y'all gonna know what I'm talking about. And that was just so impactful. They also had these mix masters, right? On the weekends, these two DJs would put these incredible mixes together. Two of those mix masters was DJ Yella and Dr. Dre. Yes, Dr. Dre. But at this time, they was in the World Class Wrecking Crew. N.W.A. and all that good hip-hop energy hadn't happened yet. We just want to make sure everybody knows this is where it begins on the 24-hour tip. Doc Winter, iHeart Media President of Hip-Hop and R&B Programming and Program Director at Real 92.3 in L.A.
So let's say I think hip-hop, the first records were like in 82. So King Tim III, and then later on was Rapper's Delight. Those records were relegated to basically you play them in the house. Nobody was playing them on the radio. I get to St. Louis in 89 and 90, and I can't remember what year Hot 97 started playing it, but I remember that towards like maybe 92, 93, it was relegated to 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. And I was the Quiet Storm host, so I came on at 9 o'clock. So the guy that had that 6 to 9 shift, his name was Kevy Kev, by the way, still with us, good brother. That was the guy that played rap. And that was the only time you could hear it on the radio. Never heard it in morning drive, never heard it. It was 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. was when the rap records came on. And he was, other than the Quiet Storm guy, the most popular DJ on the station because he played the music that the audience was just so excited to hear. And what was really good for me, and not really realizing this until later on in life, I'd grown up in New York City, so I had, you know, I grew up on a New York palette of music and taste and whatnot. And then I went to Connecticut, you know, Northern, and then I go to the Midwest. And I'm in the Midwest. And so now, because I'm in the Midwest, I'm not only getting the New York music, I'm also getting the West Coast music. I'm also probably more of the West Coast music now. So, I'm, you know, as time goes on, I'm beginning to get Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, and Tupac. So I'm getting this education where it was quite possible that if I was in New York at the time, I was probably only going to get the New York sound. If I was in L.A., I was only going to get the L.A. sound. So I got a nice palette of music. And so, you know, those records were coming through, man. And it was like, man, we were afraid in our mind if those records came on before 6 or after 9, it was going to hurt us from a ratings perspective or from an advertiser's perspective. And so then we began to experiment playing them a little more earlier on the weekends. Like, you know, it may come on at 2 o'clock on a Saturday or so, on a Saturday, not on a Sunday. Because that was, you know, that was the devil's music.
DJ Envy, radio personality and host of The Breakfast Club.
At that time, it was very local. And it was just growing outside of New York. You got to remember back then, it wasn't too many people playing hip hop. So Hot 97, and, you know, when WBLS played the little, you know, hours here and hours there, Hot 97 gave dedicated radio station to hip hop and R&B, which was really amazing. It gave a bunch of artists and it gave a bunch of people from our community a chance to pay their bills, a chance to go on tour, a chance to be heard. And if it wasn't for that station and taking the chance, I don't know where hip hop would be right now.
Yeah, you know, it was just a part of the game at that time as rap was growing, coming up, having more impact, convincing people like, no, this is not a trend. We're not going nowhere. We're going to be here for a while. And a lot of people in charge, program directors at various radio stations, record execs, you know, those few that had those positions, particularly on the black side, were just not checking for it. It was shocking to them. It was just not what they were. You know, if you think of R&B and cats wearing slick suits and doing really fly moves, I still love all of this. But this was diametrically opposed and, I mean, absolutely different in every sense of the word. And you folks that, you know, from the hood and know what I'm talking about, when you can remember, like, you saw that whole rap attitude, you know, like when you standing there in a B-boy stance, you know, with your arms folded with an ice grill on your face. A lot of it was just posing. But it was shocking to the cats that were running the game. And so they were resistant. So these were major battles, barriers that had to be broken down. And they did. Russell Simmons definitely played a key part in that. He understood this struggle as one of the few young black execs that really came out of the scene at that time. And these were the battles that were fought. And like I said, 50 years in the game, baby, these battles were won.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
Every week, we'll pick a new song from the list and talk about their placement on the revamped 2021 list.
We'll also have guests join us, ranging from the artists themselves to the producers, or simply other writers like ourselves who voted on them.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside and Britney Spears' Baby One More Time.
There's so many fascinating stories that have been forgotten, like Midnight Train to Georgia starting with a phone call to Farrah Fawcett, or how the Yeah Yeah Yeahs inspired Kelly Clarkson's banger Since You've Been Gone and Beyoncé's Hold Up. Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
Same old.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Daddy O, rapper, producer, deep thinker, and founding member of classic Brooklyn rap group Stetsasonic.
The first time we ever got radio play was a guy, there was a station in New York called WKTU that used to play mostly like dance music, and there was a guy named Paco on KTU that played King Tim III, which was a Fatback Band record that had a rap in it. And it was KTU that played Rapper's Delight first. I'm talking about in the daytime. I'm not talking about Awesome 2 or Mr. Magic or any of them, you know, Africa Islam and them. But on the daytime, you know. And I don't know what happened to Paco. You know, he stayed on the radio, but I can imagine Paco got yelled at. I'm really kidding. See him getting yelled at for playing. What are you doing? You, what are you playing this rap? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if they thought it was like street music or it was going to bring bad juju. I don't know what they thought, but it wasn't to their liking. And the other thing I think is, and this probably is not a bad thing on it, but we didn't really know how to make records in the beginning. So our records was like 13 minutes long. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'll be brutal. When we got signed, you know, we got our deal through a contest, right? We won a contest and we got our record deal. But when we had a demo, and the name of that demo was Stetsasonic. That was the name of the demo. No hook. When Tommy Silverman heard the record or the demo or whatever, he said, "This is good. I like what y'all are doing. Where's the hook?" And I said, "What are you talking? Like a chorus? Like something that repeats?" And he said, "Yeah. Don't make no hook. Like, ain't no hook in none of these. Ain't no hook in the message." You know what I'm saying? Like all the message kind of had a hook, but the rest of the records didn't really have no hook. And he said, "That thing that you say at the end, Daddy O, if you can't say it all, just say Stet. That would be a nice hook." And so we went and re-recorded it, and the record became Just Say Stet, which was our first single. You know what I mean? But the bottom line is that I say this all the time. In the beginning, none of us knew what we was doing. You listen to the first Sugar Hill Gang album, they singing on half of it and rapping on half of it. So we didn't know what to do yet. I always give Russell and Run and them the credit, Larry Smith, God bless the dead, for when Run came out with a full rap out, we said, "Holy crap, we could do a rap album."
A lot of younger people, they might not realize or might not even be privy to the information that back in the days, hip hop wasn't as, it was, everything is on demand now. So, you know, if Funkmaster Flex debuts a song on Hot 97 and miss it, you could just go to YouTube or you could just go to wherever 5 minutes later and hear it. But back in those days, man, I remember sitting by the radio just waiting to hear certain songs like Dana Dang Nightmares. That song just really blew my mind because it was such a conceptual thing, and, you know, it was on the almost like the hip hop version of Thriller, you know, he's Nightmares, and of course Slick Rick and Dougie Fresh the Show. I remember Gucci Man, Gucci Man, like Roxanne, all of those records. Even though I was a little kid, I knew it was a difference between what they was doing and what New Edition was doing and what a lot of other people was doing. I knew it was rap music. I knew it was a difference. But back in those days, New York radio, it wasn't segregated like how it is now. So you had Kiss FM, WBLS, those are the two main stations, and they would play everything. They would play Madonna, they would play Luther Vandross, they would play New Edition, they would play Michael Jackson, they would play Patti LaBelle, but they would also play hip hop. But hip hop would only be played certain times of the day, believe it or not. You know, now you turn on the radio and you want to hear a rap song immediately, damn near. But back in those days, early 80s, you would only hear it like certain times a day. So I used to just stay by the radio and I had my TDK or Maxell cassette tapes and I had it there, and I was just wanted to be so on point. Like I discovered that when you want to record something off the radio, instead of having to run and plus play and record at the same time, how most boombox was set up, you hit the pause button, then you hit play and record. So when your song came on that you wanted, all you got to do is press pause and then you start recording. And later, I'm not saying I invented the term, but later, you know, some people would call those pause tapes. You know, I'm definitely not taking credit for none of that, but, you know, I just did it. You think about all the way back to like 82, 83, it was just coming on the radio. Even though it was out in the street before that, it wasn't really getting like super crazy radio play in like the late 70s and maybe like super early 80s. I was a little too young, so I don't remember if it did, but from what I understand, it wasn't really getting that much play like in the late 70s and the dawn of the 80s. But like 83, when like Run DMC started breaking and Houdini and all of those guys started making noise and Curtis Blow, you would just be hearing all of these new songs, you know, like damn near like every week or every other week a new song was coming out, Song Pepper, and you know, you just sit by the radio just so you can just feel the energy.
And so basically, keep in mind, in this 50th year of rap music and hip hop culture just dominating the whole global music space, back at this time, if you didn't have a cassette, a homie that knew, was able to tell a friend what was really going on, you really didn't hear any rap music on the radio. It was a cassette, you know what I'm saying? Or maybe you was lucky enough to be on the block where those DJs were actually doing that thing, you know what I mean? You know, as we talked about in previous episodes, banging into the base of the streetlight, plugging in them wires to the right wire so you don't get electrocuted, plugging in that sound system, them amps, them speakers, and let the music play. That's how I went down, for sure.
Ed Lover.
Because we were so considered mainstream at that time that if you did a record, like, you know, the first time I got Protect Your Neck and Method Man, it wasn't on Loud. It was on Wu-Tang Records and it was on a tape. So we ain't gonna play that. We weren't playing that. That was like a year before they even signed to Loud. They got at me at the beach, at Jones Beach, at the Greek picnic at Jones Beach, and gave it to me on tape, you know. So they didn't really have no real major label backing them, so they wasn't going to get that. So that's where the Stretch and Bobbitos came in, and Awesome Twos came in, and even the Supreme Team, you know, before that, they were there as the outlet for these underground artists that was coming up that didn't have that financial backing from a major label.
Curtis Blow.
I was on a major label. I was guaranteed radio play. As a matter of fact, I started making these radio records and got criticized for it. But that's okay, because I did a sacrificial move, the sacrifice of making the kind of music that was radio friendly was so very important to spreading, of course, this culture around the country. That was by design. It was a sacrifice. This is what I'm saying. And there's two parts to that. Number one was I met Reverend Jesse Jackson in 1980. He came up to me, pulled me to the side and said, listen, Curtis, this thing rap is incredible.
you guys, you and your fellas are the new icons of the community. And I'm going to give you a message. I want you to take back to your fellas. And you tell them I said that this is an incredible, this culture of hip hop. But if you guys want it to really be successful and spread around the world, you have to keep it clean. And then they will play it. They will make it successful. All right. So I went back to Grandmaster Flash and the Sugar Hill Gang. We were doing our first national interview on Radio Scope. So I went to them before the interview and I told them what Jesse Jackson had said, the Rev had said, and they all agreed. All right. All right. Right then and there, we started what we call the code of ethics, not cursing on our songs, not using profanity, and not being disrespectful, just keeping it clean so we could spread it around the country.
Curtis Blow talking about his sacrifices were also strategic chess moves that broke down the barriers of resistance to the music, to the culture. I'm talking about hip-hop.
Ed Lover.
Everybody had to make a clean version, like a squeaky clean version. We played clean version. No spin back. Spin back came later. All that. No, you went into the studio after you made your dirty version and you made a completely clean version for the radio. It was none of that spin back. It wasn't none of that boing. It wasn't none of that. None of that. Woo-hoo, none of that. You made a completely clean version. When Snoop and them did, when he did the Doggy Style album, the stuff we played was completely clean. It wasn't no beep outs. It wasn't no backward spins. It wasn't nothing. Even sometimes having to absolutely change the lyrics so that it could be clean. There was no even a reference towards anything. The word was, you didn't hear on the radio. You couldn't hear all he hear ass. You know? That's why it was always with Biggie when we played Juicy. When we first started playing Juicy, it was always, if you don't know, now you know, you know. You didn't say, they didn't beep out, they didn't spin backwards. No. The FCC wasn't having that. So, you know, everybody had gone through what they was going to go through. You know, Luke and them had their thing with the Supreme Court and all of that. I remember we used to have to play the completely clean versions of their video when they would re-edit the video for Yom TV Raps, you know. We didn't play Straight Outta Compton on your own TV rap. We're going to play that video because of the imagery and all of that other stuff. Nah, we couldn't play that. Couldn't play it. There was a completely clean version of that song too. So, you know, you had to have what was palatable to the public, what parents would not complain about, and what passed FCC regulations without you getting a fine. And that was a completely clean version. Everybody did it. Ask Dre, ask Puff, ask Russell. Everybody was like, give me the clean version so I can service rate. Completely clean. Without all that, what they do now. You know, that stuff didn't exist. It was clean, clean. Super clean.
Yes, Ed, you took me back like an 8-track right there, man. That's right. Another strategic move in getting this culture to where it is. Clean versions of all the records. Hey, man, listen, it was a necessary thing to do. But I'm sure for Ed, even particular, like being a guy that was on the radio, you really knew we could only play the clean version, no matter how dope it was. But as soon as you left the radio, you knew what was being played. Right, y'all? Frankie Crocker, Frankie Hollywood Crocker, huge influence on me and my musical taste. And if you came up in New York, 70s into the 80s, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., like he used to say, if Frankie Crocker isn't on your radio isn't really on. Frankie took that whole black radio jock aesthetic, cleaned it up, polished, poised, enunciated, but he had so much flavor, was so cool. And Frankie specifically wanted to elevate black radio from where it had been, once again, in New York, the main black radio station for years had been 1600 on the AM dial. That was WWRL. Frankie Crocker brought it to FM. You know, it was originally WLIB-FM, and then they switched it up. They let Frankie have total control. So Frankie was not just the main DJ that put together all the other DJs on WBLS. He was also the program director. Frankie had his ear attuned to the mobile DJs, the disco DJs that preceded hip-hop. And when he was at those parties and he saw the crowd go crazy to records he didn't hear about, he went to the DJ, got the name of that song, went and bought that record and was playing it on WBLS within days. And he broke so many records that later became what we know of as disco. Frankie was a true pioneer with incredible music taste. But his taste was broad. If the records were dope, Frankie played it. And so he broke out of just a strict, you know, black music, R&B, soul, funk thing. And he would play something by the Rolling Stones if it was dope. Something by David Bowie if it was dope. When Frankie played those artists, he got a lot of black folks that really weren't exposed to that kind of music open and then into them. So Frankie was a true music leader, tastemaker. But once again, like a lot of older folks or folks from the previous generation of smooth R&B and soul and funk and all those things, Frankie wasn't really checking for hip hop. This was a musical revolution going on. And so he was rather resistant to what was coming. Eventually, Frankie had to give in and let it go because it was Frankie that okayed bringing Mr. Magic, who was on WHBI, where the Supreme Team, Jess Allard, the Superstar, C. Divine, the Mastermind were coming on in the middle of the week at super duper late hours. You had to have your cassette on pause ready to record if you wanted to get any kind of real hip hop. But Frankie saw what was going on. He saw the numbers. He saw the game changing. So he brought Mr. Magic over because Frankie probably played a handful of rap records, Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight or whatever, but it wasn't his thing. So it was changing of the guard. But Frankie Crocker, huge influence style-wise, music-wise, for so many reasons. Go on YouTube and just Google up Frankie Crocker. You can find some pieces of him in action and get a taste of that Frankie Crocker flavor. Doc Winter.
As I got a little older, I mean, in my room, and as I got a little older and I started driving to school or getting in the car with my brother or my friends, they would always have BLS on. And man, I was immediately entranced by Frankie Crocker. Like, I had never heard a brother speak so smoothly, speak so well, be so articulate and cool, and just like, man, this dude is the man, you know? And obviously you can imagine what it was like for me years later to actually meet him. It was just surreal. By the time I had left for college, I've become a huge R&B fan. I was able to distinguish the fact that WBLS was the heritage station in New York City. When Frankie Crocker was on the radio, you were loyal. Like, you just didn't turn the dial because it was blasphemy. And then Kiss came on. And then, you know, sometimes Frankie Crocker would, you know, he might just decide he wanted to play an hour of jazz. And you'd be like, oh, that's interesting. And then you might sneak over and listen to Kiss, maybe play a New Edition or something. You're like, whoa. And that was kind of like my first lesson before I became a program director, even involved in radio, about the power of, you know, playing the hits.
Ed Lover.
His voice, his delivery. The fact that Frankie wasn't being programmed at that time either. Frankie played whatever Frankie wanted to play. And that was the cool thing about it. Like, you listen to Frankie, you wasn't going to get the same music you got yesterday. It might be a standout record that he was really into that he would play. I found out later on he was taking a little money too. But Frankie played what Frankie wanted to play, which made Frankie so dope. He was the gold standard. Definitely of radio. He is a cool dude of radio. He missed the boat on hip hop too, but can't be mad at him because he was already into doing his own thing, you know. But definitely one of the dudes that I thought was super dope was Frankie Crocker, for sure.
Daddy O.
Tyrone Williams, Fly Ty, tells me the story of how Frankie Crocker and a few of them other DJs actually got together and started talking to other DJs and saying, yo, if y'all stop playing hip hop, we'll give you more salary and all of that kind of stuff. Like, it just, it was, I don't know. I think we were the same threat that we were to everybody else. You know what I mean? Like, there was a lot of people that saw their ending and our beginning.
On the next episode of 50 Years of Hip Hop podcast series, we'll continue with All the Hits and No Rap, Part 2, the imminent shift that helped change the landscape of radio, top to bottom, end to end. This episode has been executive produced by Dolly S. Bishop, hosted and produced by your boy, Fab Five Freddy, produced by Aaron A. King Howard, edit, mix, sound by Dwayne Crawford, music scoring by Trey Jones, talent booking by Nicole Spence.
Welcome to 500 Greatest Songs, a podcast based on Rolling Stone's hugely popular, influential, and sometimes controversial list. I'm Brittany Spanos.
And I'm Rob Sheffield. We're here to shed light on the greatest songs ever made and discover what makes them so great.
From classics like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams to the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and modern day classics like The Killers' Mr. Brightside.
Listen to Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.